Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, African leaders meeting in Nigeria discussed how to deal with continued insecurity. Our analysts suggest they look at themselves first for answers.
Governments have lost legitimacy because they deliver very little, particularly outside urban centers. The social compact is very frayed, and therefore, in places like Somalia, Al-Shabaab then steps in and says that they can offer, admittedly, a very rough form of justice, but some justice and order anyway.
Investment in healthcare across the continent is very low, in spite of a 23-year-old commitment to increase it to 15%. But is that 15% enough?
Is the government putting its money where its mouth is? That's really the question the 15% answers. But just doing that is not enough. It is necessary, but not adequate. Why so? Because we know that 15% of a chicken is not the same as 15% of an elephant. So if you have a very small budget, your 15% will still be peanuts.
And will removing the horns of rhino in South Africa protect them from poachers? It's Wednesday, the 24th of April. First, we go to Nigeria. African leaders attending a summit in Abuja, and they have called for a revamp of institutions fighting violent extremism on the continent. They'd also like to set up a standby military force, and they want greater control over peacekeeping efforts. Groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have been carrying out routine attacks across the Sahel, Somalia, Kenya, and Mozambique. Some have become active in recent years. Others have been around for more than 20 years. Civilians have been their main targets. Last year, the number of attacks by extremist groups in Africa rose to 8 attacks and 44 deaths daily, which is up from 4 attacks and 18 deaths daily between 2017 and 2021. That's according to the African Union Commission chairperson, Moussa Faki. Muridi Mutiga is the Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group. He's based in Nairobi. Let's talk about, in broad strokes, region by region. And let's start where you are, East Africa.
So this is overall quite a challenging moment from a security perspective for the continent. In East Africa, I think that the primary issue, if you take one step back, we had a lot of hope in the region. The revolution in Sudan, the peaceful uprising in Ethiopia that saw a successful change of government. But now Sudan is probably the world's biggest displacement crisis, a very difficult and deadlocked conflict in Sudan, which is very worrying. But of course, we must not forget the enduring challenges, particularly in Somalia, where you have this very entrenched insurgency by Al-Shabaab, probably the second most lethal insurgency on the continent. So it's really challenging and difficult picture.
Right. And of course, when we talk about Somalia, we're also talking about the way in which Kenya was sort of dragged into that with attacks. Let's move to North Africa.
I think the situation in North Africa has calmed a bit. We have a serious political crisis in places like Tunisia. We have complaints and you know, valid concerns about repression in Egypt. But the situation is a bit calmer now than the heyday when you had a lot of attacks, particularly associated with the so-called Islamic State. So I think in North Africa, what you have is an entrenched long-run political crisis, a lot of discontent about issues such as youth unemployment, political repression, but the security picture has improved. The question is, what will be the consequences of this very ugly war and conflict in Gaza? I think there's a lot of anxiety. There will be long-run consequences, but the security situation itself is a little more stable than it was in the past.
So would you say that West Africa actually, at the moment, has the strongest and the most serious security challenges, given that we still have Boko Haram acting there, we have various other groups, and then we have Mali?
West Africa certainly has the most serious security challenges on the continent. It's quite staggering when you look at the numbers. 22,000 fatalities from jihadism in Africa over the past year. That is by far the highest in the world. It used to be that the largest number of jihadist deaths were coming from the Middle East, particularly during the height of the Syria crisis. Today, the Sahel is the deadliest place in the world. The Sahel used to account for only about 3% of jihadist fatalities. Today, it's about 50% globally. We have then the specter of potential state failure in places like Burkina Faso, where a lot of territory has been taken up by armed groups and jihadists. We have entrenched political crises now in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, where they're all under military juntas. The worst we saw was in 2015, when you had about 20,000 annual fatalities due to the Boko Haram attacks. Now, you know, we are seeing those numbers eclipsed in important countries such as Nigeria, which Nigeria historically was the country that would try and impose order within the region.
What about Libya? And then go on to talk about Mozambique, the challenge there of the organization that's also called Al-Shabaab that doesn't have much to do, apparently, with Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
The problem with Libya is that it radiated a lot of instability into the region. The disastrous Western-led invasion of Libya resulted in a lot of arms flow into the hands of a lot of armed groups and jihadists, which then have destabilized much of the Sahel. So Libya itself is in a state of tentative calm. It's a precarious settlement between the rivals funded by oil money, but the consequences of Libya's instability have been profound for the region around it. So you're right to raise Mozambique. We've seen a slight reduction in the level of violence, particularly thanks to the intervention of Rwandan troops, but also Southern African troops. But now we know that the Southern Africans are withdrawing. They want to focus on the situation in the eastern DR Congo, which is quite unstable. But the Rwandan presence has helped to stabilize parts of northern Mozambique. But 2 points. One is that the insurgents were not simply jihadists, but they were also animated by local grievances related to political rights, related to land use of local resources. And those concerns have not been alleviated or addressed.
Those last 2 points that you make, I think, address most of the concerns, most of the reasons why we have these situations of instability across the continent. It is rooted in local justified grievance. So given that we know that that is the case, why is it that these things sort of seem to ebb and flow? How Africa as a continent been trying to deal with these issues? You can pick and choose which ones you want to look at. I know that in a lot of instances, it's the regional blocs that have tried. So ECOWAS, and then we've had SADC as well.
As you say, a lot of these groups, they wear the garb of global jihad, but in reality, they are primarily driven by local grievances. And from the Sahel to East Africa to Southern Africa, we've seen an overwhelming focus on trying to crush these groups through military means without addressing the underlying social grievances. I think that needs to change. I think that in some cases, for example, it might be possible to engage in dialogue with some of these groups. And we've seen that happen in localized contexts in parts of the Sahel, where you engage with them, potentially try and reach a political settlement to end the violence. I think the second thing is that governments have lost legitimacy because they deliver very little, particularly outside urban centers. And so you have, over the last two decades, a situation and context where governments have not really met the needs of their people. The social compact is very frayed. And therefore, in places like Somalia, Al-Shabaab then steps in and says that they can offer, admittedly, a very rough form of justice, but some justice and order anyway. And so in too many areas, governments have not really met the need to deliver on the social service scale. So I think there is really need for a total rethink. Of course, there will always be the need for military intervention, and therefore this military efforts need to be coupled with a much more comprehensive attempt at resolving this conflict.
Are there credible solutions on the table, and is there a political appetite to actually take them up?
The political appetite doesn't currently exist, but I think the knowledge does. And I think that what we see is that some of these military rulers, particularly in the Sahel, are trapped by their own sovereigntist logic. They are asserting sovereignty. They draw popularity by doing that, and therefore they have to keep escalating. But the reality is that since we all know that this very aggressive approach will not work, I think they will eventually have to rethink. And people have to consider that even when some of these solutions are very difficult and unpopular, but in reality, most wars end at the dialogue table. And so even with unpalatable actors like Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the reality is that eventually, if you are to have a stable, long-run, sustainable solution, you have to engage. So I think the sooner it is done, the better.
Thank you so much. That's been really interesting.
Thank you very much.
Muridi Mutiga is the Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group, and he is in Nairobi. Healthcare services across Africa are underfunded, and that has led to serious problems. As we speak, doctors in Kenya have been on strike for more than a month. They've been staging street protests, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. In Southern Africa, healthcare systems are in distress under the weight of a persistent cholera outbreak. If you're a regular fan of this podcast, you may have heard Dr. Paul Nwakum from UNICEF telling us why that's the case just a few weeks ago.
It keeps spreading due to the drivers, which are lack of basic social services. People are poor. They have poor water, poor sanitation, poor hygiene. And with these conditions, you can't be able to solve the problem of cholera if you don't tackle the basic drivers.
No region is unaffected by a brain drain, with trained and paid for by African taxpayers, doctors and nurses leaving the continent to work elsewhere. Cynthia Adeyeri is a writer and a nurse from Nigeria. Back in February, she told us why nurses were leaving the country.
So we have problems of welfare, problems of remuneration, problems of poor working environment, and these and many more reasons are the reason why nurses don't even want to practice in Nigeria.
State-provided healthcare standards should be higher, and this next bit of history should explain that widely held expectation. In 2001, African heads of state signed something called the Abuja Declaration, named for the federal capital of Nigeria, where this document was signed. In it, the leaders committed to set aside 15% of their national budgets to fund healthcare in their countries. 23 years later, only South Africa, Cabo Verde, and Rwanda have been able to meet that goal. Experts now say that 15%, even where it is being applied, is not enough to solve the shortfall in healthcare funding. But why have countries not been able to reach that goal? And why is it not enough? Dr. Githinji Gitahi is the global CEO of Amref Health Africa. We began our discussion with a quick look back at how the Abuja Declaration came about and why it was needed in the first place.
The reason for this was to actually improve the expenditure on health, because health was seen as a cost by governments, not as an investment. And there was a need to actually create some targets that would guide governments in their budgeting. And that's how the 15% came about.
Right. And why did they do it?
It was advocacy, Audrey. It was advocacy from civil society and other people to push governments to have a tool of budgeting for health. Health was much lower than 10%. Education had huge budgets, military even bigger budgets. And therefore, this is where the governments were pushed by advocates to adopt this 15%.
I was wondering whether there were particular health challenges that the advocates felt governments were not addressing and that things were getting worse. And that's why they pushed so hard. And that's why governments perhaps responded.
The problem was underinvestment in health, that there was not enough money to health services. And health services cover all these things. The amount of money you need to employ the health workforce, the amount of money you need to provide medicines and commodities to the people, the amount of money you need to prevent diseases. So the amount in health was low. And therefore, people were doing one, supplementing government resources with out-of-pocket. So you go to your nearby health center, you're told you have pneumonia, but then here is a script to go to your local pharmacy and buy drugs. So the amount of money that people are using to buy and to provide their own services was increasing, and therefore people are becoming poorer. So advocates felt government need to give more money to health so that they can provide for all these population needs.
So in the last 23 years that it has been in existence, this Abuja Declaration, it seems that only three countries have been able to meet the target. Why do you think that's the case?
One is lack of political will. Lack of political will, because for you to reassign and to allocate budgets, you need political will from the head of government. Secondly, it is, of course, the demands of other sectors, like especially education. Governments felt that education is a big investment, needs to be done for prosperity of the countries, and governments allocate much more to education than they do to health. Governments feel like when they put money in health, it's to spend it. It doesn't bring back immediate results, as opposed to when we build a road, we see the cars then go, people can transport their produce, and they lack to see that health is a future investment for prosperity, because only healthy populations can actually build wealth. But finally, also low fiscal space. In African countries, the GDP is very low, the population is high, so the total amount of money collected through taxes is so little that then these competing priorities actually end up with compromises, which actually are negative to the country's development. And that's how health suffers, because it's seen as an expenditure.
It surprises me when you say that governments don't see that investing in health and the health of their citizens is an investment into the future.
The challenge of government seeing the long-term returns on health are encumbered by the political calendar. Governments say, if you implement this and you put more money to health, when do we see the results of a healthier population? You'll probably see it in 5, 6, 7, 10 years, but our election cycles are 5 years. So government feel like, I would rather build a road and tell them, look, I opened a road for you, or I did this other thing for you, because it's more difficult to actually show the public, the voters, the results of more investment in health. That has been the narrative, that governments want to cut ribbons. They want to call the media and cut ribbons. So they are more driven by infrastructure. Then one of the challenges that we had was also the classification of health within the larger multilateral institutions like World Bank. The World Bank, until more recently, did not consider health as an investment. So even when they talked about health, it was an expenditure. You will remember that during the 1980s, when we had governments forced to do structural adjustment programs, they were told to cut the wage bill. Now, health is 70% human beings. They have to provide the care. And that is one of the areas that was cut. We had community health workers, they were cut. So these are part of the noise that impacts government's decision to actually put more money.
For the countries that have the 15%, how has it affected or improved the healthcare systems in those countries? And I come from South Africa, which is one of the countries that have done it. And I can tell you right now that South Africa's health services are failing, 15% or not.
Exactly. That's really the point that I've been trying to make, that the 15% is a good target, but it is not adequate in itself to actually provide better services. There are many other elements. And of course, the 15% is saying, is the government putting its money where its mouth is? That's really the question the 15% answers. But just doing that is not enough. It is necessary, but not adequate. Why so? Because we know that 15% of a chicken is not the same as 15% of an elephant. So if you have a very small budget, your 15% will still be peanuts, even if you achieve the 15%. In South Africa, the challenge is inequity. You have 15% of the government going in, but then you have 16% of the people consuming 50% of the total health expenditure in the country, and the rest of them struggling to consume the balance. So there's an inequity because of the way the health system is set up. So basically saying 15% as a floor is an indicator of commitment, but it's not sufficient.
So how is Rwanda and Cabo Verde, the other two countries that have managed the 15%, how are they doing? I know that Rwanda often scores very high on these indices.
Because of what I've just said, that 15% of a chicken is not the same as 15% of an elephant, Rwanda's budget, GDP, is low. It's not as big as GDPs of Nigeria, Egypt, South Africa. So the 15% still becomes very, very low. So the 15% of Rwanda is really more important as a political statement.
But are they using it wisely?
They are using it wisely. And then what they have done is mix it up with a partner or development aid so that it's more substantive. They have actually brought it to the table, brought development aid to the table, and now made sure that they have coherent health strategies that draw in, make sure that the development aid is riding on the back of their 15% and is not fragmented. And then they have made a statement on the social health scheme. So they have developed social health insurance, what they call the mutual. So these things actually indicate that there is a political will, and then the political will also impacts not only the money, but the policy environment.
What about Cabo Verde? How are they doing?
They are also doing the same, because Cabo Verde are also investing heavily in social health insurance and also ensuring that they are actually providing for the most vulnerable populations.
Let's take a look at the effect of a lack of funding for healthcare. Is it one of the main causes for some of the major challenges that we see in African countries, from outbreaks of preventable diseases, doctors on strike, the medical brain drain, all of those things? Can we trace it back to this lack of investment?
Absolutely. That the lack of investment is actually the result of suboptimal health services. And let me give you examples. Now, you talked about disease outbreaks, number one. Now, for you to be able to provide a health system that detects disease and responds to disease in a timely manner, you need health workforce infrastructure, you need community health workers at the ground who are able to track what's going on. You need available laboratory systems that can test quickly when there's a new outbreak to know what it is. And then you need the service delivery to ensure that those who are actually found with the disease can be quickly treated to avoid spreading to others. Now, that's health system management. Now, for that, you need money. If you don't have adequate money, the nearest laboratory will be 100 kilometers away. So even when you collect a sample, it takes you 7 days to test and find out what it is. Within those 7 days, the person from which the sample was collected is spreading the disease to others. So that's a direct impact of underinvestment. When you talk about the doctor strikes and all these health workforce unrest, it's also because of underinvestment. As we say, Africa has a scarcity of health workforce, but Africa has the highest number of unemployed health workers. This is actually an oxymoron. And the reason for this is because of underinvestment, Africa cannot afford to pay the health workers they need by the WHO ratios, yet they have them in the field looking for jobs, but they can't afford to absorb them. So therefore, you end up with fewer, you end up with fatigue, and you end up with people demanding more because they are working more. So all these issues are related to the underinvestment, yes.
Dr. Githinji Githahi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Audrey.
Dr. Githinji Githahi, the global CEO of Amref Health Africa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Service. Did you know that South Africa is home to most of the world's rhinoceroses? Rhinos for short. I don't know if you've seen them either in the wild or on television. I have, and they are magnificent. That huge horn perched above its mouth reminds me of a musical instrument, and those stubby legs make me think of my own. They've been on Earth for far longer than we've been.
but we've been endangering their continued existence for decades now. So much so that safe havens had to be set up to protect them. One of those was the Umfolozi Shushuwe Game Reserve, set up in 1895 in what later became the Republic of South Africa. It was also one of the last places you could go to see large numbers of rhino with their horns intact. Tragically, that's changing. The number of rhinos being poached in the park has shot up. Nearly 500 of them were hunted and killed last year, most of them in Shushuwe, the park originally set up to protect them nearly 130 years ago. Because they're so vulnerable to poaching for their horns, which are used for medicine in Asia, countries like Namibia and Zimbabwe have been removing those horns. Now the authorities in Umfolozi Shushuwe have started doing it as well. Julian Rademeyer is the director of the Organized Crime Observatory for East and Southern Africa at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. He's also written a book called Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade.
What we've seen in recent times, there's been significant moves within the Kruger National Park, which is home to the largest numbers of rhinos in South Africa and in Africa for that matter, where there have been efforts to try and deal with levels of corruption within the park, significant efforts to try and rebuild the Ranger Corps, rebuild morale, and then also a very widespread dehorning campaign. And that led to what's believed that that caused a displacement effect. So you had poaching gangs that were operating there, becoming increasingly difficult to get to rhinos. And when they were finding rhinos, they'd been dehorned. Those poachers moving to KwaZulu-Natal province in South Africa and taking advantage again of, you know, very high levels of corruption, issues with law enforcement, and a park that simply wasn't prepared for the onslaught that was coming.
Dehorning. Talk to us about that. I've come across it at least 25 years ago. People were talking about dehorning rhino. How does it happen and how effective is it in the overall scheme of things?
So overall, dehorning works pretty well. You know, back 25 years ago, you would have seen, you know, dehorning in Zimbabwe and Namibia. That's now increased, you know, across southern Africa. There are many private reserves that have been dehorning. For a long period of the last sort of 10, 12 years, national parks avoided dehorning, A, because they wanted people to see rhinos, you know, as they should look in the wild, but also because it didn't make practical sense to try and dehorn so many animals spread across, you know, a wide area of the park. So that's only become something that's been employed now in places like the Kruger, now that the remaining rhino population there is clustered in a fairly small area in the south of the park. And there are many other places, including Shushuwe and Mfolozi and other parks that are trying to employ this.
How do they do it? Do they literally, I mean, I can't imagine a rhino is going to stand still while you, you know, dehorn it.
I mean, there are fabulous images from the 1960s of people trying to chase down rhinos on horseback to capture them and dart them in the initial phase when they developed M99, which is the drug that they use. So it's a relatively painless process. The animal's darted, normally from a helicopter, sometimes from the back of a vehicle. Once the sedative takes effect, it's blindfolded. The horns are removed, normally with a chainsaw. And, you know, the process is over and done. There's a nub of horn that's left behind, but the vast bulk of the horn is removed. And like fingernails, those horns will regrow over time, normally between 18 months and 2 years. And then the process has to be done again.
I can't think that it's pleasant for the rhino, though. I've seen what happens when they get darted. They get so cross. And then when they wake up, disorientated, and then their horn's gone, and that's the thing that defines them. And it's not like the horn is useless to the rhino, right? They do need it.
Yeah, I mean, they use those horns for defense. They use them for, you know, digging the ground. They use them as a tool. I think particularly with black rhinos, who are quite territorial and a lot more aggressive than, say, for instance, white rhinos, those horns are needed for defense. And there's some studies that have been done, a recent one, which has shown that at least in KwaZulu-Natal province and sites there that were studied, black rhino's territory has reduced over time once the horns have been removed. The thinking behind that is that, you know, they are uncertain of whether other rhinos in the area might, you know, have full horns. They are wary of venturing too far afield. You know, they're quite solitary animals, black rhinos, and they live in quite tight home ranges. So there's these loose associations between different groups, but they don't know if the neighboring rhino has been dehorned. So they probably feel a little bit more vulnerable. But that said, it's a solution that seems to work. It certainly is deterring poaching to some degree in Kruger. It's worked very well in the past in Namibia. You know, and it's probably the most cost-effective solution out there to prevent poaching from happening. But we do also have cases where poachers do go after, you know, a little bit of horn that's left, given the value that's attached to it.
And sometimes they also spitefully kill the animal in order to register their displeasure, right?
Yeah, there have been a couple of cases like that, truly horrific cases where they've killed the rhino and just left the rhino, haven't even tried to take what's left of the horn. So that has happened.
So the National Academy of Sciences, their study shows that changes happen in the rhino. You were saying they decrease their home range. They also interact less with other rhinos. That sounds to me a lot like depression. I mean, surely. I'm just speaking up for the rhino here.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think it's very difficult to work out what exactly is motivating them. Certainly, the study speculates on a couple of possible options. The one seems to be more that they're less exploratory because they feel more vulnerable. They don't have the horn. They don't know what other animals are out there, what other rhinos are out there that could affect them, or they could end up in conflict with other animals. And these are often the large dominant males that patrol quite actively. You know, as I said, black rhinos are very territorial and tend to control their territory a lot more than, say, for instance, white rhinos.
So are there alternative methods to protect the rhino? And will it just take a longer time for that to come into effect, like increasing the policing of these animals, like punishing poachers, going, you know, after them more effectively? And then also, you know, the corruption.
You know, it's a very difficult situation. There's no single solution. So there's a toolkit of potential solutions. Dehorning is one of them. Certainly targeted investigations aimed at the criminal networks that are moving rhino horn could have an effect, and there's demonstrable examples where that's happened. There have been investigations, for instance, in the Kruger National Park into rangers who have been receiving payments from syndicates, which they've put into bank accounts, or they've opened bank accounts in the names of spouses and children and relatives. And, you know, in one particular area of the park, there now are two rangers who were arrested and around a dozen others linked to them. And poaching in that area of the park fell almost dramatically overnight. But I think, you know, the real challenge are the criminal networks. And that's not about arresting and jailing poachers. You know, poachers are the foot soldiers. They completely and utterly expendable to the syndicates. You know, this is about getting to the networks that are trafficking horn, that are moving it from Africa to Vietnam, to China, and through other parts of Asia. And that's where so much from a law enforcement perspective, a focus is needed. I think there are too many cases where we have fairly low-level poachers, you know, who are being jailed for long periods of time. And, you know, ultimately, that doesn't have that much impact. There's very little deterrent effect there, and it doesn't hamper the syndicates in any way.
And you actually have experience or knowledge of the high-level involvement of politicians, right? Tell us what you know without necessarily naming names.
Yes, no, I mean, I think there's, you know, there's certainly examples where you've got, you know, corrupt local politicians who've been implicated, there's state agencies who've been implicated, for instance, in Zimbabwe, the Central Intelligence Organization. We've seen cases where diplomats in a couple of high-profile cases from Vietnam and from North Korea have been detained in various countries with rhino horn. North Korea, you know, as an example, has long been involved in the illegal rhino horn trade going back to the late 1970s in Zimbabwe, and more recently from its embassy in South Africa. You know, the Vietnamese embassy, there have been a number of cases where people were implicated, particularly around a decade ago when the poaching crisis started. It's a high-value commodity, so it attracts people from all walks of life to become involved. And unfortunately, it also attracts some of the more violent criminal networks. You know, South Africa has a particularly high level of violent organized crime, and you see cash and transit gangs. You see people linked to illegal mining who are obtaining firearms. You see people involved in extortion or people who are running cash loans businesses, extracting information on rangers and then using that information to corrupt them and get access to horn. So there's a complex web of people that are involved.
Do you feel that we will get a handle on this, or are you dispirited about the prospects of the survival of these animals?
I think it ebbs and flows. I think a lot of people, you know, over the years have felt at times, you know, very low about the possibility of survival. I think there are encouraging signs in terms of a growth in figures, which at the moment is higher than the poaching levels. I think that also where I find a lot of hope are the people that are involved on the ground working on these issues, you know, working on conservation, but also working on broader development issues around national parks and national parks that have traditionally excluded local African communities from benefiting from conservation. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of work going on that level, which can hopefully change things. I think that there's a lot of encouraging work going on within national parks to try and address not just corruption, but the drivers of corruption. What leads to rangers becoming disheartened, salaries, working conditions, you know, all of those elements. So there's a lot more of a nuanced perspective that has emerged out of the so-called rhino war that's been going on, you know, some have described going on for the last decade. I think now we're getting to the point where people are wrestling with real solutions in ways that not only benefit wildlife, but they also benefit people.
Julian Rademeyer is the director of the Organized Crime Observatory for Eastern Southern Africa at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime and author of Killing for Profit, Exposing the Illegal Rhino Horn Trade. Focus on Africa was pulled together by Charles Kitonga in Nairobi and Bella Hassan here in London. Kani Sharp made sure we got our story straight. Our technical producer, Jonathan Greer, made sure we got on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.